and thanks everyone on this panel and all the people who participated earlier in the day. And I see the City Planning Commission Chairman Amanda Burton in the audience, I understand, and David Burney, fellow colleagues, commissioners, work on a daily basis on many of the issues that I've just seen you talking about in the last, regrettably, only the last 45 minutes or so for my own purposes, not been able to hear and see everything that has transpired today, but I certainly got a good flavor of what directly relates to our charter, our purview of the Landmarks Commission, and what Carol briefly alluded to. And I am just enormously gratified. My first thought is that isn't New York lucky? We have and particularly in the area of historic preservation, the tools that are at our disposal to be able to take on the issues that have just been talked about here are enormously important and powerful, frankly, and allow us to compile some of the statistics and records, if you will, that Carol's just spoken about. 25,000, more than 25,000 buildings under the jurisdiction of Landmarks Commission, all protected, legally protected from certainly demolition and any inappropriate alteration. So we're able to do that for over the history of four decades now or more of historic preservation in the city with a very strong landmarks law that has been challenged. Basically, it does not require owner approval. We always seek to obtain it where possible, but the powers of the commission to designate properties and to regulate them to be certain that their changes to those properties are done in an appropriate way, those powers granted under the city charter are, in fact, can be exercised without owner objection, and that includes even the designation of the property. But oftentimes we find that the most effective way to regulate and the effective way to continue to grow the number of historic buildings and historic districts in this city is through an open cooperative process. When push comes to shove and finally there's no agreement, we have the ability to act, and of course that is an enormously important tool. I know Hong Kong is of course struggling without those kinds of, we struggle enough with those powers, but without them I can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine. I've heard it and I understand. I spoke with Secretary Lamb earlier in the day and we had a very interesting dialogue, very interesting discussion back and forth, and she was actually at the commission and we were able to go through a number of things that we do and talk with various members of the Landmarks Commission staff. We have 65 people there that are doing this work on a day-to-day basis. So my response mainly is to be incredibly thankful for the situation that New York City finds itself in with respect to historic preservation. Does that mean we're doing everything we should be doing? Of course not. And that is, we strive to do more and more. And some of the new designations have gone in that direction. We have enormous support from Mayor Bloomberg, who's a great proponent of and a great supporter of the importance of historic designation. And that goes with all the other elements of his policies relating to the arts, culture, and land use that Amanda Burton is, and zoning and density and all the other things that are, but we have the ability to carry out policies that advance those important values, and we have the backing both of the strong law and the strong statute and also a strong executive that leads us in that direction. And then the disagreements start. Because we have those powers doesn't mean that they're just exercised without restraint or without the very, very important public input and part of the public process. We have hearings every Tuesday at the Landmarks Commission, dozens of items, both for new designations and for regulation of existing properties. There's an enormously widespread ongoing public process that informs our judgment, that enables us to do it better, and gives greater, when it works best, gives widespread support to the mission of the commission and for the mission of preservation. We don't have any, unfortunately, from our point of view, some of the distinctions that you've spoken about in terms of government-owned properties versus privately owned, the degree of control and regulation, everything that becomes a New York City landmark or is in an historic district, and for all intents and purposes, they're treated and protected exactly the same, whether you're one of the 1,500 row houses and other buildings in the Village, Greenwich Village Historic District where we are now, or the Upper West Side, or the Empire State Building, you still are subject to the same protections and the same controls, in the best sense, for purposes of preservation. So we do have, again, that is enormously important. I believe that many people in this audience know that. I think some perhaps do not. And I think it's a useful comparison from what we've been hearing about Hong Kong. And hopefully, as we had this discussion earlier today, I think the system in New York, with its flaws, works quite well. And I think the record speaks for itself. Have we solved all the other problems that you've been talking about, certainly in terms of density and other things that have been discussed over the last day or so? Of course not, either, also, but we work to do so. We work in conjunction, as I said, with the City Planning Commission, with the Mayor's Office, and the other arms of government, to the extent we can operate in a coordinated way. But preservation, historic preservation, is always has a major seat at the table in both in city government and also in private deliberations, private development of the kind and scale and scope that you've been talking about today. So I don't want to paint a rosy picture, because all of that happens to be true, and I believe that a lot is being done. But there are constant pushbacks, constant threats, if you will, to historic resources and historic properties, and we have to be as vigilant as we can be, and with public support, we are, and undertake that mission. But some of the other elements, it was interesting when the Landmarks Law was established in 1965, in the aftermath of some terrible losses of historic properties, including, most prominently, Pennsylvania Station, that many people know about. The Landmarks Law was enacted in 1965, and the purposes of the law touch on many of the things we were talking about today, and I'll just briefly read them. And then one was to safeguard the city's historic, aesthetic, and cultural heritage, and our landmarks can have elements of all three, or sometimes only one of the three, but that is the underpinning of why and what we do. It also, one of the legislative purposes was to help stabilize and improve property values in historic districts. And in fact, that happens to be demonstrable. That is the case. Historic districts are, in fact, there have been both specific scientific studies about it, as well as anecdotal evidence that property values in districts that are protected by the Regulation of Landmarks Commission appreciate faster than in adjoining districts that aren't. And I think that's for all a lot of good reasons. People are, there's more pride in home ownership and protection, and the Landmarks Commission regulates not only this house, but the house across the street and down the street. And so through all of that, there's a certain amount of stability and growth and neighborhood pride that is consistent with the underpinning of the law, one of the five legislative purposes. Also, another purpose was to encourage civic pride in the beauty and accomplishments of the past. It's sort of nicely, simply worded in that statute. It doesn't sound like it was written by a lawyer, but it's in the law, and I think also that's sort of self-evident. And finally, it is to strengthen the city's economy, was one of the underlying purposes of the law, and to protect and enhance the city's attraction for tourists. So I think all of these elements, when they're put together, or many of them were touched on in terms of a city like Hong Kong or any other major urban center, with the breadth and depth and interest, cultural and aesthetic, of New York City, and Hong Kong certainly is in that league, has all of these elements and can find them as the underpinning for a preservation policy. It's and it needn't be seen as a diminution or a taking of property. In fact, it can be ultimately an enhancement, and in the public, in everyone's interest. And that's what we strive to do. Again, I'm very incredibly gratified that we have the ability to do what we do, and I'm also incredibly gratified to see what is happening, certainly in Hong Kong and other places, but specifically in Hong Kong, to try to replicate some of the at least the results that we're able to achieve. Methodologies and systems will differ, but hopefully what we do here can be seen as a beacon, and maybe even some of the policies and mechanisms can ultimately be adopted, or certainly adaptively reused, if I may use that phrase, because taking into account all the differences in the governmental systems and everything else. So, and I expressed that to Secretary Lam today, and that anything we can do in terms of exchange and being helpful and talking about our successes and some of the not always successes, and what the stresses and strains are, and how we work through it, and how we are trying to work in a partnership. We'd like to be able to bring that outside of New York to the extent we can. We have a 99.9% of what we're doing is concentrated on taking care of what we're doing here, but it's good occasionally to be able to spread that message out a little bit further, and this is a great opportunity to do it today. So I don't want to be I'm not at all self-congratulatory or complacent. I know we have stresses and strains. We have a huge long way to go ourselves, but I'm delighted to be here, at least with a too long introductory remarks, and maybe have questions or comments from the rest of the panel, and maybe obviously also from the audience. And I know you're near the end of a long day, so we'll try to perhaps speed that up. What do you want to jump in on anything? How about some questions from you? Yes? Carol, how do you want to do it?
Can I speak?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Good, fantastic. My question is on the economics. Does the New York government benefit from redevelopment of private property like Hong Kong government does in terms of additional land income for you? And is there a compensation for a private owner if you stop him from redeveloping his property for the loss of redevelopment potential that he might have had out of that site? Those are the two big obstacles.
Okay. In other words, if there's a historic designation on a property, and arguably the property is not then usable in exactly the way it was intended to be, and perhaps it doesn't have that same kind of economic use. I guess the most graphic example would be historic property that's demolished and then something much larger is put on its site. Is there compensation for that? There's no compensation for the historic designation. That is part of there's nothing in the statute, and that's nothing that is required by law, and the answer to that then in a short way is no. On the first part, do we get revenues, and does the city
air rights?
Yes, we have the ability, of course, to have transfer of air rights from a designated property. There are certain benefits of a property is designated where unused air rights, if you cannot build to the extent you could, perhaps because of the landmark designation, and in an appropriate setting, those air rights can be transferred more flexibly than they could be in a non-designated or a non-landmark property. So there is some recompense, if you will, or offset to the... And then the second thing is on the revenue to the city. I think any adaptive reuse, economic development that is done in conjunction with preservation and that yields productive economic use, new jobs, new employment, new housing, new activity, redounds to the city's benefit in an economic way.
Bob, you probably want to clarify here.
Yes.
We have a property tax.
So yeah.
In Hong Kong, they make money by selling
yes.
The property, basically a lease, a long-term lease. But here, if the property is redeveloped, it may be reassessed.
Sure.
The value goes up. And that is the way the city does benefit.
Tax revenues. Yes.
Tax revenue.
Yeah, my question is, how eager is the city trying to move forward initiative between landmark preservation buildings like the New York Public Library and new LEED certified buildings like Bank of America building right down the block?
Yeah.
And are you looking to be taking a lead role as far as the world is concerned in doing that initiative?
On green buildings?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're...
How are we moving forward and seeing the balance between that, LEED buildings and historically preserved buildings? And are
yeah.
you looking to take a lead in that, New York City as a whole?
We are, the city as a whole, certainly in the 2030 program, is that's a prime ingredient of that, is the LEED certification, the green building process, the one you cited, is of course a prime example. There's nothing inconsistent with historic preservation and those kinds of concerns. In fact, it's not something that we mandate or that we are, that's a primary responsibility of the Landmarks Commission, but it is something that is increasingly seen, and we find ways to have it integrated into adaptively reused projects. So we're very much mindful of it. We very much encourage it. It has to be subject to the same kinds of rules that any other construction on a landmark property would be, but we are very anxious and always are looking for new ways, new technologies, new ways to have those values put into historic properties as well as new ones. So we're part of that, the green movement, if you will, in that sense, and we're mindful of it when it comes to the commission, when buildings come to the commission for adaptive reuse. We, where possible, like to see that happen.
Yes, I'm wondering whether a TDR program of the type that's in New York would work in Hong Kong. From the little that I've heard so far today that I understand about Hong Kong, it seems to me that the city doesn't hold the same noose constraint on height limits and density that New York does. The reason why you can transfer development rights in New York is because if you limit by, you know, boat controls and FAR controls all of the property in a neighborhood, you can sort of, it gives you a value, right? The right to transfer that height limit it counts for something. But if you have the entire neighborhood is open for development, then the city is just willing to sort of allow that to happen because it's receiving revenues from that development, then maybe those air rights actually don't have any value because the private owner can say, just go next door and build any height building they want. The unwritten sort of issue behind this is that there's this enormous pent-up value, which means that they're sort of, putting on my economist hat here, gains from trade to be made from all those underdeveloped buildings. And that winds up going, in New York's case, often to other places where it's cheaper to build, right? So Jersey City or the South or somewhere else. So there's a kind of metropolitan-wide problem of raising the expense of building, despite the fact that individual property values may go up. But the question, of course, is about for whether Hong Kong can do that and whether it would have to kind of restrain all of its development rights to be able to do so.
Like a lot of things in Hong Kong, we can and we can't. Actually, one of the things we've been trying to look into, and I'm sure Mrs. Lam will after conversations here, is the transfer of air rights. But our zoning makes it a little bit difficult because each of our sites is looked at on an individual basis. But it's not just the zoning that's the issue. It's because we have this two-tier. You've got the lease and the zoning. So it's not all in the hands of just the planning, but actually what's under the lease as well. But there is a move towards transfer of air rights, transfer of development rights, in particular circumstances. And I think maybe the government is more open to it now. If you could transfer those rights to somewhere within the same area where they feel that they could be evaluated in the same way. The problem we have is evaluating them and then trying to transfer them to somewhere else entirely. And they're quite uncomfortable with that. A lot of the heritage buildings which come under pressure are obviously in the urban areas where the values of the land and the possible redevelopment rights are very high. And the only place you could actually transfer the extent of those rights to would be to the New Territories or somewhere similar, and that's very far away. And particularly the Lands Department, which looks after evaluation of this sort of thing in Hong Kong, is very uncomfortable with that, and so is really quite reluctant to get into it. As professional values, we feel that it's not beyond the wit of man to be able to come up with something that actually would work, but it's going to take more time because of the difficulty in the dense areas of having where you could transfer those rights to. We are, one of the ideas really was this sort of voucher system, or let us see as we call them, which then would allow people to monetize and buy into developments that were being planned elsewhere which they could profit from. And maybe that's one way out, because you just have a monetary value for what you'd given up or not been allowed to utilize. There's also a bit of a discussion as to whether people and owners in Hong Kong should be allowed to be compensated for something that's not being crystallized. Because we really like to prevent buildings getting into the stage where we have to try and save them by there being some sort of rule that the owner knew that they what they could do with it without having to test the system. Last year this came to a head, a very old Chinese, well, not very old, but a very well thought of and rather popular Chinese, European Chinese mansion in Hong Kong was very badly damaged by its new owner prior to the Secretary of Development stepping in and declaring it a monument so that it actually couldn't be damaged any further, because the pressure from the public was that this building should be saved and he should not be allowed, just that the owner shouldn't be allowed to demolish it. But it was one of the very rare occasions this has happened. And this is why the foundation and other people who think this way would like to have a policy on this, so that we didn't have to just react to individual circumstances like this as they arise and try and save buildings simply because someone wants to knock them down.
What is the context of Hong Kong's desire to for preservation as compared to the more ancient cities within China and their policies of maintaining preservation of very historic sites of Beijing and other historic cities throughout China? I mean, what is the policies in these cities that impact what?
The standards and the legislation in China is actually much higher than ours. They have difficulty imposing it and implementing it, but they have got some very good conservation standards now. And of course, the really national landmarks, like the ones in Beijing, are very well protected. But that's in recent years. They've been protected almost because nobody thought of doing anything else with them until recent years, because development wasn't progressing in China to the extent that over the last 30, 40 years it is now. Unfortunately, a lot of historic housing, particularly the Hotongs and things in Beijing and Shanghai and the major cities, have been destroyed. It's part of, I think, although Chinese culture very much respects its previous history in many ways, modern China also likes what's new, what's progressive, and what they relate to being modern and moving forward. And I think that's very much the same in Hong Kong. There is an appreciation of newness, and I think on occasions that has rather overtaken the respect for history and what has gone before. And it's quite a big debate in Hong Kong. I mean, there is a lot more feeling about conservation in Hong Kong. There has been a lot of discussion, a lot of movement in the last 4 or 5 years, but by no means everybody thinks that this is necessary or particularly a good thing.
Can I add something here? there's a political context to all of this. If you look at China, then obviously during the Cultural Revolution, or during the time of the Communist Revolution, some of these old buildings were not particularly thought of to be the sort of thing you want to keep. You know, this is the bourgeoisness, or this is the example of the kind of backwardness that that is undesirable. So to some extent, there was a sort of clean out of some of the old buildings. If today we could rewind history back, then obviously a lot of monuments, significant monuments in cities like Beijing would never have been pulled down. Right? So as I said, that was a sort of revolutionary fervor that preferred certain things to certain things. And you know, it's unbelievable that China, we have all this Soviet design stuff there, right? So but anyway, that was what, that was the fashion of the era. Now in Hong Kong, what I also find very interesting is, it's a colony. And you know, for Chinese families, if we were talking about preservation, a lot of it would be preserving colonial buildings. Not, I think today we're much more relaxed about it, but I'm just thinking of the time of my grandfather, for example. You know, I mean, I think there was a sort of confusion of identity. You know, they felt very Chinese. They know they're living in a British colony. What did conservation mean? What did heritage mean? And there wasn't much of a public dialogue, I think, at the time necessarily on preserving what kind of heritage. Today, I think our generation feels quite different. You know, I mean, our heritage is all of these things, all mixed into one. And we're quite comfortable with all of that. And today, when we're talking about, you know, that picture of Star Ferry, maybe somewhere in the world, people would say, you want to preserve that? You know, it's a pretty ugly little thing. But again, we're going back to something that I find very interesting, because the community asked itself, this place, not necessarily, you know, how great it looks and so on, but this place, the part that it plays in our collective memories. And when this campaign was going, you know, people were saying things like, oh, my mom met my dad there, or they went dating there, or, you know, that's where I went, you know, fishing with my friends or something. These things were all kind of flooding out. And I see that these kinds of moments, these occasions, it crystallizes an awareness that had reached a majority view. Let's put it this way. We look at the sort of curve, right? You know, we've kind of gone past the 50% line. These things are flooding out. And of course, this is a very clear message for, I think, people in the commercial world, you know, what Hong Kong people want, provide that. For government policy, what people now demand, you know, what, and I think as you all know, changing policy, policies have a whole range of assumptions behind them. And, you know, to get to where we want to change those policies, are actually really pretty hard. So we are going to see a lot of one-off, you know, it'll be very ad hoc because it's easier to deal with that one building now than to shift the whole systems. But of course, I think over time, we are going to need to see how to take all those steps so that these things are preserved. And one of the things we also need in Hong Kong is a legal back system for archives. Because for all these buildings and monuments that are no longer there, we need the archives of we need to preserve them so that when we reach back, we have that. And then, of course, all the new decisions that are being made. Right? We need government, we need our public records to be properly protected, and we're one of the few jurisdictions in the world that do not have a legislatively backed archival system.
Well, as with my prerogative of asking, posing, let's say, one final question for this session, and I'll pose the question, and then I'll also give you some time to think about it, if you have some ideas to offer going forward, and then I'll inform the audience about the wine reception outside. But my question would be ahead or behind, in the broad view of a dialogue between the two cities and what we can learn from each other and how we confront the challenge of the 21st century going forward. What is it about Hong Kong that's ahead, and what is it about Hong Kong that's behind? Because we focused the last bit, half or so, of the discussion about heritage and about tradition and about the older streets. And the separation between yesterday and today with the rationalized multi-level city, the efficiency of transit. I, 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 um, I,
I think that the separation of those two ideas in so many cities and so many voices in cities tend to go off in opposite directions. If we could weave back the goals of efficiency and sustainability and how to deal with crowds and congestion and density and the vitality, are there ways that those two things can be put together constructively where the two cities don't just say, well, you do this bit better and then we could try to do that more like you, but how is the future going to be different in ways that we can weave the problems and the experiences of other places into a global urban context of successful cities so that New York 20 years from now and Hong Kong 20 years from now aren't two little 8 million person cities who are losers in the bigger scale as Shanghai takes over with the energy of the future or Dubai takes over as the next business center. How do those things come together? And so if you think for a moment about that, who's going to answer first? I'll mention that thank you very much all for sticking out this long afternoon. We have a wine reception outside just in the courtyard around. We encourage you to meet each other, all the participants in the audience as well, to continue to ask your questions of the participants either in the social setting immediately outside or here after. But to come back, I hope, at 6:30 when Carrie Lam, Secretary of Development, the aforementioned secretary, responsible for this whole wide portfolio, will talk about her efforts in Hong Kong, and the dialogue will continue with Amanda Gruden, who's here, so that they will also engage these ideas about how the cities can succeed together with their past and their futures. So do you have any ideas to offer as final comments? No.
it's a very interesting question. And I think it's all to do really with livability at the end of the day. I mean, there were clearly things that each city can learn from the other, and I think some of the dialogue that we had yesterday and some of the talks today sort of raised some very interesting points, really. I think yesterday people were tending to admire the presentations that related very much to transport efficiency, the integration and urban management issues in Hong Kong, which makes this very compact, very high-density city remarkably workable, really considering some of the things that Nick was talking about. You know, the fact that many, many people live in what in most Western countries would be termed very deprived conditions. Hong Kong has a surprisingly good and an essentially very very sustainable environment, I think. But I worry about Hong Kong in the future, and I think the gentleman who raised the question about what is happening in China was on a very interesting tack, really, and Christine's answer I think was very pertinent, that there is a political dimension now. Hong Kong has changed so much over the last 20 years. It's changed economically, it's changed culturally. But I think in terms of people who actually live in the city, there's been a kind of complete sea change, because right through the 20th century, Hong Kong was a city of immigrants. And Hong Kong was a kind of staging post, really. People didn't identify with either the place or its history, or particularly its culture. Almost every, I may be sticking my neck out a little bit here, but I think certainly the last two or three generations, the majority of Chinese who emigrated to America, all came through Hong Kong. So it was something of a staging post. And there is now an acceptance in Hong Kong, certainly, of the importance of the importance of identifying with Hong Kong through its history, through its culture, through its memory, and I suppose I think the things that we can learn most from New York really are the things that we were talking about earlier. Really, we've lost walking around New York in the last couple of days. very interesting. I mean, it takes your breath away that we have a high-density city that's so diverse, that's kept its cool, if you like. You know, the great buildings, the density, but the heritage is actually there. And one of the things that really impresses me, and I have to say, when I listen to people talk in Hong Kong, and they say, I've been walking around Hong Kong for 24 hours, and this is my impression, but nevertheless, the thing that really impresses me is how workable this urban matrix actually is in Manhattan. You can walk around it and through it very easily. And at the end of the day, what are we really talking about in terms of our great environment? It's not necessarily great buildings, which is something I try to draw out in my presentation. It's the street environment, the frontages, you know, the way it actually works physically, the mix, the flexibility that the fabric actually has of presenting so many different options, its receptiveness to change and so on and so forth. And New York seems to have handled that very well. And of course, it's had many years to develop very sophisticated legislation that protects the city, protects the environment, but it also protects the city from doing stupid things. And we have not got to that level in Hong Kong yet. We are still doing remarkably stupid things because, and I'll finish in just a moment, because we've inherited an incredibly simplistic government planning process. If you look at our hierarchy in Hong Kong, we have finance, we have lands, and we have planning and environment way down there. And we've got to kind of turn that on its head. It is happening slowly. I think there is a difference in perception. But we do have a long way to go. And the way we've set up our organizations, like the Urban Renewal Authority, with incredibly simplistic ordinances. And not only that, but they themselves are almost operating with two legs and one hand sort of tied together because of the way that government actually makes policy decisions about planning. You know, we have an urban renewal strategy that doesn't come from the Urban Renewal Authority, it comes from the planning department, and that really reflects lands and financial interests. So, you know, we have these problems and we've got to somehow unglue them. Very interesting question. I would say we can address to Carrie later on this evening.
Kristen, you know, your comment that New York, Hong Kong, we're going to be sort of 7-8 million people, small city. Right? We're looking at the trends that are coming, these mega cities that are coming up in many parts of the world. You know, what are we going to be? Well, I'd like to think that where we are is we're going to have to offer a kind of a quality of life, a kind of new vision of prosperity that is inspiring for not just us who live in these two cities, but you know, for the rest of the world. And that is only creatable if we are able to put in place the wisdom, the experience, and the systems of managing these cities, of developing these cities as we go forward. And we know, I think, today that you know, even when we talk about wealth and money, it's going to have to be rooted in people, well-being of the people, how they live, how they feel. So can we take what you have evolved in New York that is interesting? It's also your tremendous civil society engagement at so many levels, you know, from universities to think tanks to,
museums,
different regions, you know, different districts, how people are engaged. How do we can, you know, Hong Kong can reflect on your experience. You can perhaps look at a newer city because we are, you know, our shape, our cityscape is still evolving, whereas yours have settled down to a great extent. We're going to kind of go down your path in a way, you know, so I think we want to learn from your good and bad experience. And that conversation, you know, that civil society, government to government, institutions to institutions. I mean, I can imagine that you could be helping, collaborating with us to host a whole series of these discussions that make sense for both cities as we go forward and be the 8 million or thereabout great cities.
Right.
I'm all for that when we start the series. And I think we have a lot to learn. I learned a lot today in the speaking with Secretary and then on this panel very briefly, of course, and I agree with you. You walk out this door of this auditorium and you turn to the right and walk down the street. You're in a historic district and you're feeling a sense of place and you're feeling all the kind of energy and things you talk about in a microcosm of the civility of the city. So I hope we're showing that well, and then from the processes and procedures that help produce it, as well as we're both cities of immigrants. You talked about the immigrant, different kinds of immigration waves, but I think there's much more in common. And lastly, I would say that the waterfront, the ferries, you talked about the ferry terminal, but the Star Ferry, and the way the animation and excitement of, which I've had the great privilege to see, of your waterfront and your harbor is something that we can and should learn from. So I think in all those areas we can, I agree, with these two tiny little 8 million cities, as the world goes further, let's just keep them the way, keep them in that scale and size and scope, and strengthen them. I don't think that the size necessarily is a limitation at all.